Hello everybody, James here. Storytime with Dutch Mantel, episode 69.5, aka Ask Dutch Anything, episode 13, I think. I'm going to just start calling these Ask Dutch Anything, but anyway, very, very quick plugs, and then we're going to get to asking your questions to the crafty veteran, Dirty Dutch Mantel. And, oh, we are doing plugs very briefly. Okay, then, so Dutch would like to... Your camera collapsed there as well.
We did?
No, it's come back again now. And Dutch Mantel has signed books available over his left shoulder, and also the University of Dutch diplomas that are doing very, very well indeed at the moment. You get two signatures with them, Dirty Dutch Mantel, and the provost of the university, Zeb Coulter. And to get those, you go to Dirty Dutch Mantel with two L's at gmail.com, and you make your request there. I've got two books as well. I've got my YouTube channel with Shane Douglas. I'd like to direct you to Franchise University with Shane Douglas. And, of course, we've got books from Amazon if you want them signed, obviously. You know, the email, I've said it before. Now, let's get to the questions, Dutch, and the first one is from Dave Tyler. There's been some renewed interest in matches that devolve into shoots recently, and especially the legendary catastrophe between Andre the Giant and your old friend, Akira Maeda. The story was that Andre was told to teach this young Maeda a lesson, but Maeda had other ideas. So we're going to watch a couple of minutes of the match, and you're going to do some critiquing of it. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
Okay, we're back, and this is from 1986 in New Japan. Now, do you want the backstory, or should we just crack on?
No, just give a little bit of the backstory here, so they know what we talk about.
Okay, then. So the backstory is that Andre was meant to be... Well, he turns up absolutely drunk out of his mind, and he was told he needs to teach the Akira Maeda a bit of a lesson. But the problem is, this is Andre the Giant in 1986, not 1976. And he's very much more overweight, and he's just not moving how he used to. And young Akira Maeda has been chopping away at his leg for a considerable amount of time after Andre started going for Akira Maeda's eyes. So, we'll just play this. In fact, I'm even going to go a little further up. Where am I going to go? Up to here. So tell us what we're seeing, Dutch. We've seen much.
They told Andre they wanted to teach this young Maeda kid a lesson. And Maeda, he possibly wasn't getting along with that. What company was this?
New Japan, so it would have been Inoki.
Inoki. And Inoki didn't much like him because this kid is, he could see he's an up-and-coming star, and he wants Andre to teach him a lesson. So what you're seeing here is about what they did for the first 20 minutes of this match. It's boring as hell. All Maeda did was kept kicking Andre's leg. He would take his right foot, his right leg, and he would kick Andre's left thigh bone or the thigh area. And this went on and on and on and on. And Maeda, he was trying to take Andre down. He eventually did take him down. But what are you going to do with a guy 400 pounds or maybe more?
Yeah, and the rest of it.
And to take him down, you couldn't do nothing with him. No, yeah, he tries to. But he didn't really take him down. Andre just falls. Andre was drunker than Cooter Brown. And those Japanese fans are all over the place. And it finally gets to the point, and we'll see it here in a minute, that Inoki comes out of the dressing room himself. And I don't know who this guy is. I think they tried to get something else going to make the match a little more exciting. Hang on a minute. Knocked it over, buddy.
There we go. That made the podcast more exciting. You knocked the microphone over.
Oh, yeah, well, but I saw this years ago, and look at it. You can tell Andre he don't give a crap anyway. And what are you going to do to Andre if he don't want to do something? And Maeda, probably he didn't want to do it either, so he has. Now, look at Andre. He's laying down and saying, pin me. And there he is. There's Inoki. He's madder than a wet hen. and he wants to go in there and kick the crap out of everybody, which he probably could, but I never understood the whole purpose of this.
So you know what the story is where Inoki's coming out, is apparently that...
No, Inoki, he knows the match is just completely dying.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, these people, he knows they're going to... All these journalists and all these photographers here, they're going to bury this match in tomorrow's paper or in tomorrow's news. So all he's trying to do here is trying to kind of get something interesting that is... That he can maybe, I don't even know how they even describe this. But Andre, look at Andre, he's still down. And Maeda's saying, oh, I'm going to try to cover you now.
That's been thrown out. What was the disqualification for?
I guess everybody getting in the ring because, and I think Inoki went out there to do that. But a weird, weird segment that happened damn near 40 years ago.
Bear with me one sec. Right, so apparently the story is that when Inoki came in, Maeda turned around to Inoki and said, can I finish him? And Inoki said no. So, you know, he was frustrated, and we've gone through the whole thing there. But I wonder, I mean, you can take me back to 1986.
Well, okay, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Who was supposed to win this match?
Great question. I don't know.
Can I finish him? No, he can finish him if Andre wants to be finished. What are you going to? I don't get it. I don't get it at all. I would like to have been a fly on the wall in that dressing room when Inoki, Maeda, and Andre came back. Of course, I'd have to speak Japanese to know what they were talking about. But I would really like to know the dressing room's response or the feelings about this. And I would like to know what Inoki thought about it. Crazy. So.
Now, you know, in the mid-80s, you were in Japan a couple of years earlier. You got knocked out by Maeda with a spinning heel
kick. Oh, yeah,
kick.
Maeda. Yeah. I wish Andre just beat the crap out of me to pay him back for knocking my ass out about 4 years earlier. Yeah,
we need to rewatch that sometime. That's a story for another day. I know we've told it, but we can always rewatch it. But in 1986, in the climate in Japan, or anywhere wrestling-wise at this time, with all the magazines and all the photographers around, do you think that harmed Andre? His reputation?
Oh, I doubt it. When did Andre die?
93.
So this was only 6 years before he died?
Yeah, this was actually the year before WrestleMania 3, you know, the big Hulk Hogan, you know.
Well, he was wrapping his career up anyway. So, and you could tell by the way he moved. He was in bad shape. And so this was the year before Hogan and Andre in WrestleMania 3, right? Was that it?
Yeah.
Well, it's a very interesting. I'm glad you brought this up because I had actually forgotten this. So they had some heat between Maeda and Inoki.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it Inoki and Andre
that
had the heat?
No, I think Andre was the hitman in this situation, hired by Inoki or somebody who didn't like Maeda. And obviously Maeda are going to be a star himself, you know, elsewhere soon afterwards.
I think right after this year, I think the next year, I think when he jumped to that new company, the IWA or whatever it was.
It was like UWF.
UWF. I think he jumped to that either in 87, I think. I'm horrible on dates, so that's what you're good at. But it looks like the political waves at this point in Inoki's company was getting a little bit rough, and there was a lot of bad feelings on both sides.
Now, amazingly, Akira Maeda actually continued with New Japan for another 2 years before jumping to the newborn UWF, not the original UWF, but
okay.
We will move on. Now, Robin has asked, do you remember getting powerbombed by Sid on WWF Raw after Bradshaw screwed up? Would you like to watch that?
Well, not really, but we will.
Yeah, oh yeah, one sec. Okay, and we're back. And as said before, Sid and Bradshaw having a match, and you've already wandered in, causing a commotion.
Yes, I have.
Things off here tonight. Oh no.
Here we go.
We got him. Yep. Oh, boy. The cowbell to the top of the head. And let's do that one more time. Let's shoot him in here. And let's do this clothesline. Oh, he's smart. He ducks it. And he gets both of us. The crowd goes wild.
Sid has got his detractors. I was really like Sid. He moved like Frankenstein. Just, I really liked him.
Well,
I can tell you what, Bradshaw.
Yep. Takes up Bradshaw. I don't think with a lot of help.
No.
And then look, he looks at me. Now, what have I done to Sid? Nothing. And he grabs me by my hair, gently puts his leg over my head. Oh, my God. And here he goes. Oh, my God. That hurts just watching it.
Does it actually?
No. It doesn't hurt. But you get used to these bumps. And see, if I tried to go in the ring now and do that now, I wouldn't get up. So you get used to it. And once you get used to it, we were working every day too, but I wasn't taking bumps. That was for Raw. That was a special deal. So
how soft was the ring or otherwise? We've heard the old WWF rings are
These rings weren't bad, but they still were stiffer than an ordinary ring. The rings in Memphis, when you hit those, it would go down as much. And then it had a sound to it. You were actually you'd bounce up sometimes, but you wouldn't bounce up from a WWE ring because they had no give. They had 2x4s and they have a spring in the middle, but you don't need a spring if the floor is not going down. What do you got a spring there for? But anyway, when I was there, they weren't too bad.
How do you take a powerbomb perfectly? So how do you get yourself up there? Do you post off the knees or the ankles, or just yoke you up and you just go for the ride?
No, you help yourself. You control yourself. Because, brother, some of those doped up bastards, you're trying to control as much of it yourself because you're the one going down. So, and a lot of times, say, do you think I could slam a 260-pound man? Hell no. It's a special way to do it. He goes up. And the best way, if you can get him up and he's just stretched out and he just stretches his back when we go down, you just put him down. You put him down flat. You don't put him down on his head. You don't put him down on his shoulders or his feet first because it's all messed up. You spread that bump out. So he's taking it on all of his body instead of one part. And that's how you avoid getting hurt.
Was Sid generally safe?
Oh, yeah, he was. And you see, he took his time. And I had known Sid up to that point for, I don't know, probably 10 years, 8 years anyway. And he's always a good guy. So, and he actually took better care of me than he took care of John. And he didn't put either one of us down hard. Because if you do that one time, the next guy, or if you want to do it to him again, he can say, I'm not doing it. You hurt me last time. I'm not doing that. Because if you got hurt back in those days, now we go back to the pioneer days. If you get hurt in WWE then, you didn't have those contracts. Oh, you had a contract, but it wasn't defined money. You were defined how much money you would make per match, the minimum. But it was only good for $1,500. And then after that, they could just refuse to book you and wanted to block you from going somewhere else, which was illegal. But to prove that's illegal, you got to go get a lawyer, which costs money that you didn't have. So, and I have heard some guys just walk out and quit and just start working independents. And the WWE would try to sue them, and they just throw it in the trash can.
Next question. Dale Fortuno. Hey, James, hope all is well. I feel as though everyone you have spoken with has had an interaction with Hakushi. Could you ask Dutch about him? way ahead of his time in America. Thanks, bud. So do you remember Hakushi? He was the Japanese fella who had the tattoos all down his torso, like in lines.
In WWE?
Yeah. You and Bradshaw, well, Bradshaw wrestled him. You managed him once.
Well, that wasn't real tattoos. They would draw those on every week. No, I only know about Hakushi from being in WWE with him. I've said hello to him and goodbye, and that's basically the extent of it. No long, drawn-out stories about the guy. Who was his manager?
Wasn't that
I remember him. Sato?
I can't remember.
I think Sato.
Okay.
Now, I knew him a lot better. But I don't know Hakushi that much.
Damn.
But me and John had a match with him. Mm. Hakushi.
Yeah. We sure.
What are you looking for now?
I'm not. I've given up. I've just put my phone on airplane mode. Every single time I take it off, I'm getting phone calls for stuff and I don't need to know it. Right, next question. Dylan Calvert. Hello, I listen to every episode. Why didn't Sid Vicious ever get brought back to the WWE after the buyout of WCW? Now we know what happened in WCW at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. Sid had a little bit of a hot streak in him. And he was kind of, I could see where Vince loved him at start. But then again, I think he started being a little bit of a, trying to have it his own way. And Vince didn't like that. So when did he leave WWF to go to WCW?
Now, which time? The first time or the second time? I'll tell you both. 1992, shortly after WrestleMania 8. So that was, he probably left the first time in like April and went back to WCW then. And then he came back in 95 and he was in and out for a couple of years. And then he just disappeared probably by mid-97. And then he reappeared in WCW over 2 years later. So he must have been doing some indies at the, you know, at that time.
Well, he's probably sacking away that insurance money that he got paid in a settlement when he broke his leg. Now, I saw that. I wasn't there, but I saw clips of him breaking that leg. It is brutal because it went from here to like a 90-degree angle. Oh, it is even hard to watch. And I don't know how much money he got out of that. Do you know?
I don't know.
I heard $5 million.
God bless him for getting that, because WCW was hit with a lot of lawsuits. In the end, there was like racial discrimination lawsuits and other things like that.
You know why? Because you knew that WCW wasn't going to close up shop and file bankruptcy. So if a bank, if they had a judgment against WCW for whatever amount, they had to pay that amount. See, a lot of people who get charged in civil suits and they're supposed to pay all this money, they just, and businesses too, they just basically file bankruptcy and you just get whatever's left over.
But that was Time Warner Media, you know, an AOL. They weren't, they managed to kill themselves off pretty soon afterwards, but with the, you know, most expensive business failure merger in the history of the world, I think, at the time. But they were going to declare bankruptcy.
They weren't going to declare bankruptcy?
WCW closed up shop in 2001, but the parent company, Turner Broadcasting, after the merger, they were still
that's
going.
That's who's responsible for the lawsuits, correct?
Yep. They would have been the ones paying out.
Now, and what was the question about? What was your last question there?
Well, it was, why did Sid never go back to the WWF? Oh. But I mean, Sid didn't go back to wrestling for years, did he? After the leg break?
No, I think he went back to Memphis. I don't think he lives in Memphis. He lives in West Memphis. And he didn't want to go on the road anymore. And I don't blame him. So, especially in the summer. You know what he plays in the summer?
Softball.
Oh, softball. So if you tell a guy, listen, you can work you can work the summer and make $1 million. All right, you can stay here and play softball with your buddies. So Sid says, well, hey, I don't want to go out. I got money anyway, so I'm going to stay here and play softball. Now, he did. He ran a few shows on his own. And I don't know how well they did, but they did okay, I think. But he likes to be home, and he don't want to be out in Spokane, Washington, or wherever, Portland, Oregon, because that's too far from Portland. That's too far from Memphis for him.
So I'm looking here. Obviously, he broke his leg January 2001. Didn't wrestle for years. I think he, as far as I can tell, he made an appearance in 2004. Not a singles match. Then he started doing indies, you know, 2007 to 2011, about that. And very, very sporadically. So, you know, he made his money. If you say he won $5 million from a lawsuit, would you have your leg broken for $5
million? Would I do what?
Would you have your leg broken for $5 million?
Yeah, I probably would.
By Dynamite Kid?
I would push through the pain, give me $5 million, and let me go.
Let's move on. Anthony S. I'd love to know Dutch's opinion on Triple H in and out of the ring and how he's doing as the head of creative at WWE. Also, if he spent much time with him in his WWE run as a manager. P.S. Don't be too harsh on him, please, Dutch. As many seem to be, I really like Triple H. So, Triple H, but I'm going to be more specific here. Triple H as a wrestler, as a person, during the mid-90s run. So what did you think of Triple H during the Hunter Hearst Helmsley years?
Well, I always enjoyed being around him. He was always very, very nice to me, because I think he was nice to the guys who had a history in wrestling. He respected that. And when we would go to Europe, he would. I never heard the guy one time ever raise his voice to anybody. He was always soft-spoken, basically. And he wouldn't tell somebody, hey, this is what I want. He wouldn't be forceful with that. He would say, listen, this is what we got in mind. And then he'd lay it out, which is basically the best way to do it. And I think he's doing very well as the creative head. And that's a very, very important job, because you're not thinking about 2 weeks or the next pay-per-view. You're thinking about the next year and possibly farther than that. You got to be, you're in the long game, not the short game. So I think he's doing very well. I liked him. And I think everybody else likes him too. And I never knew him of getting any backstage turmoil other than what Shawn Michaels probably engaged him in. But he was like always actually a pretty good guy.
With that being said, I know it's obvious, I know it's easy to say in 95, 96, or, you know, in hindsight, but I mean, Triple H was a lot smaller, you know, because you get huge, you know, bodybuilder physique afterwards, but, you know, he had a character. He was in the middle of the pack. He was built more like a swimmer than, you know, like a wrestler in the eyes of maybe Vince at the time. Could you have predicted championship, heavyweight championship, face of the company, you know, within 5 years at that point?
Oh, I could have.
Really?
Well, I saw how they were using him. Because if you have to, when did he marry Stephanie?
Well, in storyline, late 1999, but he started going out around earlier 2000.
Okay. Well, he became a member of the family, and Vince knew that Triple H was never going to go against him. He knew that Triple H would never take a trip down to Atlanta and go to WCW. He's just not going to do that. He's a member of the family, and they wanted to build as much stuff around him as they could, because they know they got him, because he's not going anywhere. So whatever they do is not going to be lost because all of a sudden this other company comes up and offers him a lot of money. Hell, he was sitting on all the money in the world that he wanted, him and his wife. So why would he go anywhere? But could I see him having the title? Yes, I could, because they were building it to get there. And you know, as well as anybody else, WWE, they take their time when they do this. So you got a lot of time to sit back and study exactly what they're doing. And now, I couldn't have guaranteed it, but I could see it.
Next question, DS Dutch. What are your thoughts on Terry Taylor during your TNA run in catering? Many wrestlers that have done interviews.
Wait a minute. I love that. My run in catering. Well, it started off slow.
It was a heck of a run.
Then it picked up when they brought the banana pudding in.
He did some of the best work there, let me tell you. Many wrestlers that have done interviews have called him a yes man. Wrestlers don't come off very often as liking him professionally or personally. So what do you think of Terry Taylor?
In what company?
TNA. TNA when he was in the office.
Well, let me say, who asked this question?
He's identified himself as DS.
DS. Well, let me tell you, DS. Terry Taylor had like a talent relations job. And his job was to protect the company. That was his job. So quite naturally, he's not going to walk out in a room full of wrestlers and say an F TNA, F Dixie Carter, because guess what would have happened? He'd have been fired immediately, and he's now looking for a job. So, I met Terry when he first broke in. And I had to stop and really think about this. Me and Dennis Condrieu were talking to him, and I think we were in Knoxville. And we were telling him about this match. We're going to get heat on this. And you come in and boom, de boom, de boom, de boom. And then we'll wait for when you get tagged, a big pop. So he got that word in his head, the big pop. And then he got to talking, and he says, and then I'm going to give you the big payoff punch. I went, what? He said, the payoff punch, the pop, the POP. And that's what he thought that was. And me and Dennis, must have been the way he said it, because we started laughing. We didn't stop laughing for 5 minutes. But he knew absolutely nothing. He had no timing, and we was trying to teach it to him. And I do feel sorry for him when he went to WWF, when they gave him that. What gimmick did they give him?
The Red Rooster.
God, I'm at it. I'm watching, and I think they did that to Terry as a rib, as a joke.
Oh, not according to Bruce Pritchard. The only person on earth who will defend that gimmick. As no. He was like the cock of the walk. You know, we were trying to sort of get that cocky aspect. So he dressed him as a chicken.
Well, it didn't work. And according to Terry, it kind of killed his career. I don't think Terry did ever recover from that. But now Terry was over when he went to Mid-South. Bill Watts liked him. And, you know, I think they had plans for him then. You know, Terry's wife died about 10 years ago, maybe. No, more than that. Because she was sick when I was in TNA with him. She was very sick, and I don't know what she had. And he had two young boys, too. So, and then she passed away and left him with two young sons to raise. But, and I'll say one thing for Terry Taylor. Terry called me about a year ago, out of the blue. I haven't talked to Terry in years and years and years. And he just called up and said, hey, I was just thinking about you. How you doing? And blah, blah, blah. And a lot like, you know, the Ricky Morton interview that we did recently, you know, Ricky actually doing the interview, actually thanked me for teaching him this and teaching him that. And I would like, when I leave this business, I want to leave it with people saying, you know, Dutch helped me. And I haven't really found anybody, except I've found a few that said I was an asshole. But by and large, I don't think you're going to find many people to say that. So, but Terry, he called me out of the blue, and I appreciated that. But that chicken gimmick didn't help his standing within the fans of a pro wrestling. He kind of laughs about it now, but it's not funny. Because I'm thinking, or just think for yourself, you go to WWE, like that's the peak that you could go. Say you go there, James, mm-hmm. And you get there, and the first night they tell you, we got a hell of a gimmick for you. And you said, I can't wait to see what it is. And all of a sudden, they unveil a chicken suit. And you say, they say, you like it? And then they tell him the gimmick that you're going to be the king of the walk. And they want him to go, buck, 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 buck. So I can see why he didn't like it. So they may think that they had big things planned for him, but whose idea was this? Did Bruce ever say?
That I don't know, but I mean, there's only Bruce and Pat and Vince basically at that point. So do you want to have a look at an interview with the Red Roosters? 30 seconds.
No, let me see it.
One sec. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Let's watch this thing. Turn it off.
Crazy, he's so excited the match has been signed. The rooster is no longer brainwashed. He's no longer under the wing
sure
of the weasel.
Jesus.
And things are going his way. WrestleMania 5, Heenan, I don't know where you got the courage. You signed the match, and I can't wait till the day. It's everybody saying, you taught me how to win. You taught the rooster to be a big star. Well, now it's time for this student to surpass the teacher. You taught me how to win. You taught me how to be a star. Well, now it's time for the student to teach you how to lose.
Jesus wept.
Oh.
That's an astonishing artifact.
Oh, my God.
Who could have sat back and think, you know, I see money in this?
Oh, yeah. I said, wow. Well, the gimmick table will go crazy on this. What merchandise we can sell off a rooster?
Chicken hats. I don't know why they did thing on it.
Why didn't they get Tyson's Foods to sponsor the thing? Tyson Chicken? I think that's the name of the company. This is a big company that has chicken, but it put a wet blanket on any hopes he'd have about being a big WWF star. So
let's move on to the next one. Will H.
I think he had his phone with a cock-a-doodle-doo when it rang. Hello, Vince.
Hey, well,
that's
yeah.
I cannot believe you put that up.
I didn't put it up. Someone else, yeah, I just showed it to you.
Oh, okay.
You can't blame me. Next one, Will H. Will here from Richmond, Kentucky. I wanted to say love the podcast. It's the best by far. James, you and Dutch make a great team. Now my question is, how has Paul Heyman remained relevant after all these years? Is he an ass kisser or a brilliant mind?
Well, he's a little bit of both.
You think?
Oh, yeah. How's he going to last all those years up there with all those backstabbing bastards? He had to get in there. And I think he got in there a long time ago because Paul Heyman is an excellent salesman. He sold ECW to WWE. In such a way that they thought they had a really piece of property. And they did, probably, because they're looking at the content he is producing. And if you read about Paul Heyman, some of his early years, he didn't pay a lot of guys sometimes. You know, little Chris Candido?
Mm-hmm.
Candido, according to his brother, would go and buy tickets, airplane tickets, for the guys and submit the bill to Paul Heyman. I think when Chris passed away, I think Paul still owed him like 30 grand in actual money that he had gone. Now, here's another thing. I used to hear a thing about Paul Heyman and airplane tickets. I was in an airport once. I don't think it was Atlanta. It could have been. I looked through the glass, and there's Paul Heyman at the counter with a whole bunch of like stacks of paper. And what he would do, he was taking these tickets, and I forgot, I don't know if he was upgrading them or downgrading them. Oh, he was changing. he was changing the person's name who's on the ticket. He had a credit card, and he was, and the only thing that he wanted to do was get his name, his credit card name or number on these tickets, I think. Then he would take all those tickets and just turn them back in. And where's the refund going to go to? Mm-hmm. The last number on the ticket, which was his credit card number. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I did see him spend about an hour at a window with a gate agent at some airport on the East Coast. I do know that, whether that's true or not, but I've heard stories about that for years.
You know, the comedy of that is that Paul Heyman was fired for that by, I think, Bill Watts. And then Paul Heyman turned around and sued WCW and won. So I think a lot of that money ended up helping support either ECW or the other thing he was trying to do with Jim Crockett Jr. We probably have got... Oh, there's so many questions. We'll do possibly two. We'll see how long this answer is.
You always do this. You say, we're going to do two. Then we do two. Then you say, okay, we're going to do one more.
Two.
One more question.
Two. Okay, two more. I promise you two. Madison okay. Joyce, and I'm going to do the very, very quick version of this because there's a lot of David Schultz stuff. But let's just...
Oh, I love David Schultz.
Let's just give the last line. Your deep, deep thoughts on Dr. D, David Schultz.
That is one tough bastard. He don't care. He don't care. Even when he punched... Who was that announcer he punched in the face?
John Stossel slapped.
Yep. And Vince was right there, slapped him, slapped the hell out of him. I used to ride with David quite a bit. We were teamed up in Memphis. And David sometimes would just roll down his window. We'd be riding down the road, and there's a sign. He just, boom. He just shoot the sign with a gun. He'd shoot about three or four. And he thought that was the greatest thing in the world. So one night, we're in this town right down below Memphis. And this guy kept walking by the dressing room, and David was looking out the door, and I'm looking out. We're watching the matches. And one guy said, hey, F you, David Schultz, F you, F you. And then David said, come here a minute. I said, I ain't coming over there. No, come here. I want to ask you something. Kept it up and kept it up and kept it up. Finally, the guy finally figured there was no threat in David. He said, no, come here a minute. I want to ask you about that girl. So he said, he looked around and said, that girl over there? He said, yeah, come here, come here. And he came over there. David yanked him in the dressing room and, you know, pushed the door shut. David beat the living crap out of him. And what did I do? Hell, I had nothing to do with that. I stood completely clear of that. So then he threw him back out there and he said, now get the hell out of here. If you come back, I'll do it again. Then we look out there and the guy has a policeman and we see him talking, blah, 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 blah. And he told me to come in here and I come in there and look at my eye, look here. And then he looked back and saw us. He said, look, they're watching. They're watching me tell you this. And he said, they know they're guilty. And the cop told him, he said, hey man, I don't know what to tell you. You can go down to City Hall, you can take a warrant out, but ain't nothing. I'm not going to go in there. But David was rugged, which fit exactly into his next line of work as a bounty hunter, because David would, and he wasn't scared either. He wasn't afraid. David was big. David was about 6'3", maybe, I don't think he was 6'4", but he was kind of tall and he weighed about 260. And brother, he had a mean streak in him. So when he told him to come here and if he had to take him down, he'd take him down. So, but David, I liked him. He liked me. See, that's my strategy of getting along with all these tough guys. Make them like you. Be funny. Laugh with them. Then I'm not getting the crap beat out of me. But David, I think he was living in Jackson, Tennessee. I don't know if he's still there or not, but here's another story about David. We were in Louisville, Kentucky one night, and we were wrestling. It was me and David versus Rocky Johnson and Bill Dundee. And some guy, he's drunk as hell, and somehow he was on the floor right there. And David said, "Get in here, get in here." So the guy just stepped up to the ring and got in. And we had the belts, but in those belts, it was like an eagle. But the eagle, the top of the eagle's head extended out of the belts about this far, which was, I've never seen a belt like that, but they had it. And when the guy come in, David took his belt and he hit him right in the head. Oh, he dropped him. And then David started putting the boots to him. And what did I do? Again, I said, "Hey, I don't have nothing to do with it." And the deal is, Rocky Johnson and Bill Dundee raised the rope for the guy to get in there. And finally, the security run in there and got him. He was bleeding like a stuck pig. And they drug him out. And nothing ever happened about that. And David thought it was funny that the guy got in there. But I did hear that the guy, he had trouble for years after that. I don't know why he didn't sue David. Because I was in a ring. If he'd sued David, he'd sued me too. And I didn't do anything. So to say David was a badass is saying it mildly.
I want to pick up on something you said before then. You said that in the other story where David beat up a fan, took him in the back, smacked him around, and then he was talking to the police. And then the policeman said, according to your story just then, "I'm not going back there." Were the police ever actually afraid to go in the locker room for any reason? Or was that just something for him to get out of having to file the paperwork?
This is years and years and years ago. This is when a lot of people were still believing that wrestling could be a shoot. So if that cop said, "Hell, I'm not going back there," you know, the cop told us, the cop come back later and told us what he told him. He says, "You can go and down to City Hall or mayor, wherever, and take a warrant, but I'm not doing it. I'm not arresting. I didn't see it happen. I'm just going." He said, "You're out here, y'all messed up. I don't know what happened."
Final question. And I promise you it was only going to be two. So final question. Ben Martz, I'm wondering what Dutch thinks Vince Russo's best idea ever was in TNA.
Well, I think his best idea he could have had was to get rid of me and just let me go on and do something else. But, hey, people can knock Vince, but he's never at a loss for an idea. Never. Whether I think it's good or whether you think it's good or a fan thinks it's good is, you know, that's a personal choice. But he's never at a loss to do something. An old timer told me one time, the worst idea is the one that's not pitched. I've told you that before. So even though an idea can be really crappy, still, if you bring it up in a creative session, that may spark somebody else of having an idea similar to that, and it may start you off. Red Rooster. What was that song? The Red Rum. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Red Rum. Red Rum. Yeah. Red Rooster.
My brother made me watch that film when I was 9. That was, I wouldn't watch it when I was.
The Shining?
Yes. I hate that film. It's too scary.
Oh, I love that. I love that movie.
I hate horror films. My brother just ruined horror films for me because he made me watch them when I was a kid.
You didn't like that?
Not when I was 9. No, I shit me pants when the little twins were in the thing. Do you know what really got me in The Shining? Is towards the end, there's a bit where all the ghosts start materializing in the hotel. And there's one bit where a door's open. And isn't like there a guy dressed as a bear with a girl in the room and they're only there for 2 seconds? Weirdly, that was the thing that freaked me out the most of that film. And the twins.
Who's producer of that movie, real quick?
Vince Russo. No, Stanley Kubrick directed it.
That's it. And I used to love his movies, too. Mm. Do you like the Coen Brothers movies?
Yeah. I've got a Big Lebowski poster.
Oh, yeah.
Over that shoulder there. But, yeah, I don't... No Country for Old Men's great. Big Lebowski's great. Fargo's great. I've seen quite a few. Not seen them all.
But if you see a bad one they do, it's really bad. But they don't do that many.
Example?
But they were good. I'm trying to think. I can't think right now. But most of their movies have been really good. And I've enjoyed them all. So what was our last question?
Something about Vince Russo. We're going to shut the podcast down now. You've got a week to think of Vince Russo's best storyline ever, but I'll leave that with you. But for now, thank you very much for watching. If you want your question answered, or if, to be honest, you just want us to ignore your question and start talking about Coen Brothers movies, you're welcome to do that as well. You email questionsfordutch@gmail.com, and many, many of you are indeed. So if we don't get to your question, you know, soon, then send it back in at some other point, and hopefully we'll get around to it then, because we're just getting just deluged. Another word I'm sure you like, Dutch.
I like that word, really.
But
hey, I like answering questions because hell, it don't cost you nothing. Mm-hmm. So make sure you subscribe.
Yes. Oh yeah, we're nearly 100,000 now, so we should be.
No, we're not. How close are we?
95.
Oh yeah, 95. Well, I thought you said it was like 98 or 99.
No. But I think we'll get to 100,000 before Christmas.
Good. Well, we should. Anyway. Folks, go to the site. Where is the site?
YouTube.
Yeah. That's how much I know about this stuff. Go to YouTube and subscribe.
There you go.
Do that for me.
There you go. And for now, thank you very much for watching. We'll catch you again on Friday. Dutch, pew, pew, pew. We the people.
We the people.